Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first ever Murder Monday on Late Night Crimecast. I'm so excited to do this because I'm so interested in learning about murderers, the psychology behind their actions, just everything. I plan to do Murder Mondays once a month on a random Monday. You'll probably know that I'm going to post a Murder Monday because I will not be posting the Wednesday before. Instead, you'll get two episodes in the upcoming week, which is why, as you can see, I didn't post last Wednesday. So, I guess, let's just begin. Oh, but first, I should do an introduction. I'm your host, Robin Steffens. You may or may not know me from my YouTube channel, in which I have a crime series based around kidnappings, murders, and the criminals themselves. This show will be very similar to that. So, if you're like me and you love true crime, especially if you get tangled in those cases that just keep you up late at night, you're gonna love Murder Mondays. Today we are gonna talk about one of America's most notorious serial killers, John Wayne Gacy. Gacy was a serial rapist and killer that murdered 33 men. He was also known as the Killer Clown, so trigger warning if you're afraid of clowns. This guy is literally your worst nightmare. Gacy was born in Chicago, Illinois on March 17th of 1942. He was born to his parents, John Stanley Gacy and Marion Elaine Robinson. Gacy was the middle child and he had two sisters. He was said to be close to his sisters and his mother, but he had a very difficult relationship with his father. His father was abusive and he was also an alcoholic. Gacy always sought approval from his father, but he was often verbally and physically abused by him while growing up. His father would always compare him to his sisters. He would call him dumb and stupid. I mean, he had an early childhood memory of his father beating him with a belt for moving his car engine components. He was 4 at the time. He was also struck in the head with a broom by his father. He was knocked unconscious, and there were several more incidences of clear abuse all throughout his childhood. His mother tried to shield him from the verbal and physical abuse, but it only made his father pick on him more. His father would call him sissy or queer, and even several of Gacy's friends say that there were instances where the father would just hit Gacy for no reason. He would shout at him and start hitting him without being provoked. They said that Gacy would never hit his father back. So I want to clearly note that Gacy was also a perpetrator and victim of sexual abuse. In 1949, he and another boy had been caught sexually touching a young girl. He would have been around 7 at this time. He was whipped as punishment by his father. Then later that same year, he was molested by a family friend. He never told his father about this incident in fear that his father would blame him. Outside of all of the abuse, Gacy was also bullied. He was an overweight child and he had a heart condition, so he couldn't get involved in sports. He easily became a target for neighborhood and school children. Basically, he had a very traumatic childhood. Verbal abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and the bullying. I just want to make this clear. Trauma is the single recurring theme in the biographies of most killers. It's very common for serial killers, murderers in general. They have these certain traits, and it's very common for them to have experienced some kind of abuse when they were younger. And clearly, Gacy has experienced so much abuse, so much trauma growing up. Now, moving forward to later in his life, in 1960, at the age of 18, Gacy decided to get involved with politics. He began working as an assistant precinct captain for a Democratic Party candidate in his neighborhood. He thought that maybe this would help him gain his father's acceptance, but it actually turned out that his father criticized him even more and started calling him a patsy. Of course, this would have crushed him. All he cared about was his father's approval, but all he got back from his father was name-calling and abuse. But despite his father's disapproval, he ended up buying Gacy a car. And of course, with every good thing that his father might have done for him, there was just so many more bad things he would do back. For instance, his father started to hold this car over his head. He would take away the keys from Gacy whenever he felt. He would take out parts of the car whenever he felt, just so Gacy wouldn't be able to drive it. Gacy really started to hit a breaking point with all of this, and he just decided to leave home one day. He drove to Las Vegas, and he worked there for a while. He got a job as an attendant in a mortuary. During this job, he would watch morticians embalming bodies. In an event he later confessed to, one night he got out from his cot and he went into the coffin of a deceased teenaged male. He then began caressing and embracing the body. Now, even to him, this behavior was something that was just a shock. He didn't understand where it came from and he knew it was wrong. Soon after that, he ended up calling back home and asking if he could come back. His father agreed and Gacy drove back the same day. When he got back, he started college at Northwestern Business College. He graduated in 1963 and got a job within a show company. In March 1964, he ended up getting engaged to one of his coworkers, Marilyn Myers. They married in September of the same year. Now, fast forward 3 more years to 1966. He's accepted a job offer from his father-in-law to manage 3 KFC restaurants in Waterloo, Iowa. At this point, he's earning the equivalent of $115,000 a year. In February of that year, he ends up having a son named Michael with his wife. Then, in March of 1967, he has a daughter named Christine. This period of his life, Gacy describes as being perfect. He had the job, the family, and he was finally getting his father's approval. He said that in July of 1966, not too long after he had his first child, his parents actually came to visit him in Iowa. His father ended up apologizing for all of the verbal and physical abuse and told him, "Son, I was wrong about you." Now you can imagine Gacy is finally getting what he wants. He's successful. He has a family. He has his father's approval. He pretty much has everything at this point. Ironically enough, right after this short period of perfection, Gacy committed one of his first sexual offenses. In August of 1967, Gacy lured a 15-year-old boy named Donald Voorhees to his house with the promise of showing him pornographic films. He gave the boy alcohol and persuaded him to perform oral sex on him. In the following months, this happened to many teenage boys that came in contact with Gacy. Gacy would even use the front that he was conducting homosexual experiments for scientific research and would pay them $50. It was in March of 1968 that Voorhees, the first boy Gacy had assaulted, told his father about what had happened. This led to Gacy being arrested and charged with oral sodomy, and also being charged with attempted assault of another teen. Gacy, of course, denied these charges publicly, but was still indicted on May 10th of 1968. On August 30th, 1968, Gacy persuaded an 18-year-old boy named Russell Schroeder, who worked for him, to physically assault Voorhees. He wanted him to do it so that this boy wouldn't testify against him in court, basically using scare tactics. But as you can guess, this didn't turn out well. I mean, Schroeder agreed to it and he did it, but he was quickly identified as the attacker by Voorhees. This led to Schroeder being arrested, and of course he confessed that Gacy put him up to do it. This landed Gacy another charge. After all of this had happened, Gacy was actually required to undergo a psychiatric evaluation at the Psychiatric Hospital of the State University of Iowa. He was examined over a period of 17 days before it was concluded that he had an antisocial personality disorder and was unlikely to benefit from any therapy or medical treatment. They also reached the conclusion that his behavior pattern was likely to bring him into repeated conflict with society. Despite this, Gacy was still seen as being fit to stand trial. On December 3, 1968, he was found guilty of sodomy and was sentenced to 10 years at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. The same day he was convicted, his wife also filed for divorce. She requested possession of their home, their property, sole custody of their children, and of course, monthly payments for alimony. This was all granted to her on September 18th of 1969. Gacy never saw his first wife or children again. Now, let's move on to his time in prison. In prison, he was known to be a model prison mate. You know, he kind of went above and beyond. He supervised projects to make things better for the inmates and was pretty productive in prison. His father actually died while he was in prison. Now, you would think that he would be unmoved by this, but it's reported that he actually broke down. Like, he collapsed and was in full tears after learning that his father had died. He tried to get out on something called supervised compassionate leave, basically used when there's something like this, death in the family. But they actually denied his request. His father died on Christmas Day of 1969. And even though he wasn't let out of prison for his father's funeral, he was actually let out of prison for parole on June 18th of 1970. Just 18 months after his 10-year sentence. The condition of his parole was that he would relocate to Chicago to live with his mother and that he was to observe a 10 p.m. curfew. June 19th, he was in Chicago with his mom and got a job working as a cook. It wasn't long, though, until Gacy was finding himself in trouble again. On February 12th, 1971, Gacy was charged with sexually assaulting another teenage boy. This boy claimed that Gacy had lured him into his car and driven him to his home, where he attempted to force himself on the child. This would have, of course, been a violation of his parole, but the boy ended up not showing up to court, so the case was dismissed. The Iowa Board of Parole did not learn of this incident, and 8 months later, in October 1971, Gacy's parole ended. The next month, Gacy's criminal conviction in Iowa was sealed. During that time, around August 1971, Gacy and his mother moved into a new house in Chicago, and then Gacy became engaged to a woman named Carol Huff. She was a divorcee with two young daughters. She moved into his home soon after they had announced their engagement. Gacy's mother ended up moving out of the house shortly before they ended up getting married. It was 1 week before Gacy's wedding, on June 22nd, that he was arrested for aggravated battery and reckless conduct. A teen named Jackie D informed police that Gacy had impersonated a police officer, flashed a sheriff's badge, and lured him into his car to force him to perform oral sex. These charges were later dropped after the teen attempted to blackmail Gacy into paying money in exchange for dropping the charges. Regardless, on July 1st, 1972, Gacy got married. He also ended up quitting his job as a cook and starting his own construction company. Now, before I get into the next part, I really want to talk about the psyche of serial killers. A huge serial killer that I know the majority has heard about is Ted Bundy. He's had numerous biographies, movies, and books written about him. It's just crazy, but he was a very charming guy. Said to be handsome, but really, I think it's more than that. It's personality, and you see this a lot with serial killers. Serial killers are very smooth, and that's why, while it may seem crazy that they were able to get with their crimes for so long, they typically are good at talking their way out of a bad situation. Like, the same way we were able to maybe lie to our parents about taking an extra cookie out of the cookie jar when they weren't looking, they're easily able to lie about murdering people and committing atrocious acts. They're able to mask who they really are. So while we can look back and see that they were horrible and monsters, at the time, they may have been very well-liked or even more well-liked than normal, regular, everyday people. I just want to say that before we dive back into talking about Gacy and his history, so you can kind of see where I'm coming from, and the psychology behind it all. Gacy became very active in his community and again became involved with the Democratic Party in Chicago, just as he had in Iowa. In the picture, he even has a badge on that confirms that he had Secret Service level clearance. This is what I'm talking about when I say that he has this mask that he and serial killers like him have. How convincing it can be, and, you know, he was known as being outgoing and helpful in the community. He was sort of a community leader. He put a lot of work in, and on the outside, he seemed like a wonderful family man, a wonderful neighbor, a hard worker, but clearly, there was something going on underneath it all. He was accused of rape by two more teenagers in the mid-1970s. This led police to start questioning him about that and also about the disappearance of several teenage boys in the area. Now, here's where the clown part comes in. Around the same time, Gacy became aware of a clown club called Jolly Jokers. It was a club in the area that would do fundraising events, parades, and entertain hospitalized children. In late 1975, Gacy joined the Jolly Jokers and created his own performance characters. One was Pogo the Clown, and the other was Patches the Clown. Gacy designed his own costumes and taught himself how to apply clown makeup. He did a lot of charitable work with this and became well known as Pogo the Clown. And while this may not seem connected, I think it is, because in 1975, Gacy also told his wife that he was bisexual. They had sex sometime that year, and he told his wife that it would be the last time they would be having sex. They stopped having sex, and he simply stopped coming home as much. He would come home early in the morning after a night out and tell his wife excuses about where he had been. Not only that, but she observed Gacy bringing home teenage boys into the garage, and she also found gay pornography inside the house. The reason I think this whole clown thing and him telling his wife that he was bisexual is kind of connected to each other is because I really think that this year, 1975, was some kind of awakening for Gacy. Like, he had been spending so much time trying to bury his perversion, but it seemed like he had truly succumbed to this bad behavior that year. He had finally become more true to himself, no matter how demented his truth was. He was even so upfront about it to the point where he was bringing these boys, clearly teenage boys, to his home in front of his wife. I mean, there was clearly something wrong with him, and it seems like he really started to kind of not grow aware of it, but grow more comfortable into it by 1975. With all that being said, he and his wife ended up getting a divorce in March of 1976. So in between 1976 and 1978, Gacy is just living his life without getting into too much trouble. He refers to this time period as his cruising years. This is the time that he has the house to himself, as he's now divorced, and this is the time that he ends up committing his most murders. It isn't until December 11th of 1978 that his fall begins. A 15-year-old Des Plaines High School sophomore, Robert Peist, disappeared shortly after leaving work at a pharmacy where Gacy had recently completed a remodeling job. Gacy had spoken to the kid about there being an open position in his company, and it's assumed that the kid left his home to chat with Gacy about it. So immediately it's determined by police that Gacy was the last person to see this missing boy. The police quickly find out his past history in Iowa with the sodomy charges, and they find out that he's been arrested many times for similar offenses against teenage boys. So they really start to put a lot of work in heavily supervising Gacy. At first, Gacy takes it with great stride. He even invites over some of the detectives that are doing surveillance on him, and he makes jokes about burying bodies and makes remark that clowns can get away with murder. This was until they served a warrant to his home on December 13th of 1978. During this time, they discover several suspicious items. These items include a high school ring for the class of 1975 with the initials JAS, handcuffs, drugs, drug paraphernalia, two driver's licenses that were not issued to Gacy, child pornography, police badges, guns, ammunition, a switchblade, a piece of stained carpet, hair samples from Gacy's automobiles, store receipts, and several items of teen-style clothing in sizes that could not fit Gacy. They also noticed an extremely foul odor in the home, but couldn't locate the source. They figured that Gacy was a pedophile, but had nothing linking him to the Peist disappearance. Eventually, they end up talking to Peist's parents again, and during the conversation, Mrs. Peist mentions a conversation that she had with one of the employees working on the night her son went missing. The employee told her that she had borrowed her son's jacket when she went on her break and left a receipt in the jacket pocket. This is the same jacket that her son had on when he left. That same receipt was found in the evidence collected during the first search of Gacy's house. This proved that Gacy had been lying and that Peist had actually been in his home, but they were still trying to build up evidence against him. So that wasn't actually what got Gacy arrested, but he was arrested when he performed a drug deal in front of the surveillance, aka the detectives. So then a second search warrant is executed while he's in police custody, and three lime-covered bodies are found in a crawl space. Afterwards, Gacy starts confessing. Gacy points officers to the precise locations of certain bodies in the crawl space and states that he had lured the victims to his home, either for sex or through the promise of employment, and then strangled them. Authorities eventually discovered the remains of 27 corpses. They discover 27 under the house, plus two more under the garage and driveway. Eventually, Gacy told police that he had thrown four other corpses into the Des Plaines River. It was later discovered that Gacy had committed his first known killing in 1972, taking the life of 16-year-old Timothy McCoy after luring him into his home under the impression that he could stay there for the night. According to Gacy, he said that the boy woke him up the next day after he had spent the night and had a knife in his hand. Gacy thought the teen intended on killing him, so he charged the boy and got control of the knife and stabbed the teen to death. He then realized that the boy's intentions was not to kill him, but that breakfast was ready. That he only had the knife because he had been in the middle of cooking. Despite the fact that he hadn't intended to kill the boy, Gacy says that he couldn't deny that he had become sexually aroused to the point of orgasm by killing the boy. Now, I honestly think this story and the way Gacy presents it is a complete lie. I mean, he has a very violent and perverse track record, and I wouldn't be surprised if he had planned to kill a boy like that for a long time and just had finally stumbled upon his victim. Regardless, Timothy McCoy was the first to be buried underneath the house in the crawl space. After that first murder, Gacy continued to accumulate more victims in between 1972 and 1978. Gacy went on trial on February 6, 1980 for the murder of 33 young men. He had retracted his confession and his defense lawyers tried to prove that Gacy was insane, but the jury of 5 women and 7 men did not agree. After only 2 hours of deliberation, their jury returned a verdict of guilty and Gacy was given the death penalty. On May 10th of 1994, Gacy was executed by lethal injection. His last words were, "Kiss my ass." Okay guys, that's going to be it for today's Murder Monday. I hope you guys enjoyed this and will continue to join me again on Wednesday for this new Late Night Crimecast episode. I really enjoy doing this Murder Monday and I will definitely be keeping up with it, so look out for it in later months. Thanks so much for tuning in. Good night from Late Night Crimecast.